WBEZ's Nonprofit Spotlight is supported by UChicago Medicine, providing expert primary and urgent care with locations throughout Chicagoland. Their walk-in urgent care locations offer a variety of services for adults and kids 7 days a week. No appointment needed. And for the visits that can wait a day or two, flexible hours and online scheduling make it possible to find a primary care provider partner. Learn more at uchicagomedicine.org.
How does AI even work? Where does creativity come from? What's the secret to living longer? TED Radio Hour explores the biggest questions with some of the world's greatest thinkers. They will surprise, challenge, and even change you. Listen to NPR's TED Radio Hour wherever you get your podcasts.
You may not know this, but the majority of women will get fibroids in their lifetime. But why? And what even is it? This is Reset. I'm Sasha Ann Simons. Fibroids are very common tumors that grow on the walls of the uterus. And the main thing to know is that they're also non-cancerous. According to Johns Hopkins Medicine, up to 70% of women will develop them during their reproductive years. And they're particularly common for Black women, most of whom will get fibroids by age 50. But if fibroids are mostly benign, why does it matter that they're so common? Well, the answer is more complex than you may think. We recently invited Dr. Constance Adams, an OBGYN at Northwestern Medicine, to help explain. Now, my colleague and WBEZ editor Natalie Moore sat down with the doctor for Reset. So I'll toss it over now to Natalie for that conversation.
I want to get through some basics first. There are a couple of health conditions that might look similar to fibroids. I'm thinking about endometriosis and PCOS. Please clear this up for us. What is the difference between these three conditions, and how do they present? What are the symptoms? Yeah.
So to start off with fibroids are benign growths of typically the uterus. And so the symptoms that you can have are going to more so be about where they are. If they're in the lining of your uterus, you may experience more heavy bleeding. It may also impact fertility. If they're in the wall, you may have heavy bleeding and pain. And if they're on the outer aspect, you tend to have what we call bulk symptoms, which means that just the pure pressure of where the fibroids are in relation to your other organs. You may have symptoms based off of that. Endometriosis, the easiest way to describe it is the inner lining of your uterus, which is your endometrial lining. How we describe endometriosis is that portions of that lining implant outside of the uterus. And so as a result, they're trying to respond in the way that they would if they were an inner lining. And as a result, a lot more women have really bad pain with cycles. So people who are otherwise okay, then suddenly when their period's coming on, they're in debilitating pain. That can be often how endometriosis is found. And then with PCOS or polycystic ovarian syndrome, it's a full spectrum disorder. So it can come in a variety of different ways. And so classically, people may have little to no periods. You may have a polycystic appearance of your ovaries, meaning you have several follicles throughout your ovaries that give us that polycystic appearance. You also may have signs, what we call hirsutism, which is where you have abnormal hair growth in different parts of your face. You may notice having a lot more acne. You may notice a lot of male pattern baldness. And it also has a lot of impacts later on in health. So people tend to be are at a high risk of being pre-diabetic or diabetic. They also may have higher blood pressures and different things like that.
Who gets fibroids?
So I think estimated what we say is about 70% of women by age 70 will have had a fibroid at some point in their lives. So a lot of women get fibroids. However, there are certain populations where we're more likely to get them, including Black women. We're probably more likely to get them than most other people.
What treatment options are there, and when is surgery necessary?
It's all going to be based off of the symptoms that you're having from your fibroids. And so kind of going from least invasive to most would be one is expectant management, where we don't really need to do anything about them. And people who have fibroids where they don't really require treatment are those who are overall not having symptoms. So these are people where we incidentally find that they have fibroids, and their fibroids are not causing pain, they're not causing bleeding, they're not causing any issues with fertility. But then people who are having symptoms, we can do a couple different things. And so when we go to the medical options, fibroids fibroids can be treated with hormonal treatment. So things like hormonal birth control pills, the IUD, the implant in the arm, such as the Nexplanon, that can be a couple of different things. There's also some non-hormonal options. For example, transistemic acid is something that can be used to treat fibroid, or heavy bleeding, at least, that's related to fibroids. For people who are experiencing more bulk symptoms and pain, there are a couple of different things, such as the uterine fibroid embolization procedure, which is essentially where small beads get placed by interventional radiologists that starve the blood supply that goes to the fibroids, and it results in them shrinking over time. You also have different other medical interventions, such as like the Sonata device, which you can also see a shrinkage of fibroids that way. And then there's also more invasive surgeries, such as myomectomies, which is where we can pluck fibroids out and sew your uterus back together. And the most definitive way to manage fibroids is with hysterectomy, where we remove your uterus and your fallopian tubes.
And so, doctor, it sounds like most women will get this, or they already have it and they don't know. So what is the diagnosis process or screening? Do you find it out during your regular pap smear, or if you're saying, oh, I'm having really strong periods, are you tested then?
It tends to be based off the symptoms that people tell us about. So, for example, if a woman is having an issue or having children, they may go to their fertility doctor and they have an ultrasound. That's usually where we start, is with a vaginal ultrasound. And on that ultrasound, we can see evidence of fibroids in that way. Also, if people come to the office and they're saying, I'm having heavier cycles, I'm having a lot of pelvic pain, I'm having a lot of discomfort with sex, hey, I'm feeling like there's just a lot of pressure down there, all those may be other indications where we would start doing imaging. Or if someone has a history of having fibroids in the past, that may be someone else who we would end up screening to see whether or not their fibroids have returned.
And so if a woman is listening and is wondering, am I one of these people who has fibroids right now, is this something that she should be worried about?
It's a really good question. So it really just depends on where they are and kind of what your overall goals are. Right? Like, a lot of women come into my office and they say, oh my gosh, Dr. Adams, I heard I have a small fibroid. Like, what does that mean? Like, am I going to be able to have kids one day? Like, is this going to be something I have to like get removed one day? And I tell people, if it's more so incidental and they're not in the lining, or they're not in a location where we would really see that impacting your fertility, we don't actually need to do anything clinically about them. But if you're having symptoms, then yes, you would need to talk to your doctor and you would need to tell us so we can at least start the screening process.
Well, you know, a lot of women get dismissed at doctor's office and pain is regularly ignored. Is there some sort of self-advocating that women should do?
I am a big believer that if you are seeing someone and you don't feel heard and you don't feel seen and you feel like you're being dismissed, there are so many other physicians out there where you can go see someone else. There's never harm in getting a second opinion or even just continuing to ask questions. Like, I tell people all the time, I'd rather you come to me and you ask me the question. And if you don't like my answer, I'm very open to referring you to other people so you can get a second opinion. You can, when you go into places, you can ask questions like, hey, I'm having these symptoms. I heard about fibroids before. Or someone in my family has fibroids, or a friend has fibroids. Is there any harm in screening me for this? Like, if you're not screening me, can you explain to me why you don't recommend right now that I get an ultrasound? And by asking it that way, it kind of puts people in a position where they're able to say, well, here are my explanations. And if it makes sense to you and you agree with that, great. And if not, you can always go get a second opinion.
So let's say your childbearing years are over, mm-hmm. or you're not interested in reproduction, mm-hmm. and you have fibroids. Is it just okay, you have, if there's no pain, should you just let it ride out?
If you're not having pain, heavy bleeding, if you're not someone who's really experiencing symptoms, part of why fibroids grow are through hormonal effects. So estrogen and progesterone are part of what causes their growth. Once we go into menopause, the growth of the fibroids essentially stops.
Okay, now what about perimenopause? Because that is where I'm at right now.
And so perimenopause, the thing about it is you're still having hormonal changes. Like, you're still in a position where you might be having periods. You are still in a position where you could actually still get pregnant. I tell people all the time, just because you're 48 or 49 and you're not having monthly cycles, if you, like, there is still a chance. And so even in that time frame, you still can have growth of your fibroids. Now, if you were having heavy bleeding when you were 49, and I'm making up an example right now, and then you're noticing your bleeding is getting less frequent, and then you stop having periods and you're in menopause, your symptom of your fibroid is essentially gone. But if you're still having the bulk symptoms, you're still having the pain, there's nothing wrong with advocating to ask people, like, hey, well, should I do anything about this right now? And so I just make sure it's very individualized, and so it really is going to be important to have that conversation with your provider.
So we had on Chicago Tribune music critic Britt Julius last week talking about her health journey, mm-hmm. and she was diagnosed with a rare form of endometriosis. I can say that word. And here's Britt talking about her experience with fibroids.
After about a year or so of having really heavy periods, really debilitating periods that kind of came out of nowhere, my periods in my 20s were very light and very simple. I was diagnosed with having fibroids. This was 2018, and then in the summer of 2018, I had fibroid surgery to sort of help reduce the size of them, and hopefully they would go away. It wasn't a perfect surgery. In fact, the doctor I had at the time said, "You're the only patient that I've had who hasn't been a sort of roaring success."
Does this sound familiar to you?
In the sense that she had complications with her procedure, or that she was diagnosed with the fibroids after having heavier cycles?
Both. Was this a unique scenario? And I'm not asking you to diagnose her because she's mm-hmm. not a patient, but just thinking about, you know, someone who just the problems weren't going away.
So what I will say is, initially, it's not uncommon where people first start to notice that they have a change in their cycles. Typically, I'll tell my patients in the office, like, if you're noticing that back-to-back your cycles are getting heavier, more painful, et cetera, communicate that with me so we can talk about whether or not we need to do imaging or see if we can try other medications that can help minimize your symptoms. So it's not uncommon for people to experience changes in their cycles. With her procedure, without me really knowing, like, exactly what she had done, it's hard for me to really weigh in. But I do always tell people, anytime we do any kind of intervention, there's always going to be the risks that are associated with it. I don't know what exactly her complications were, but I can say most surgeries have some possible risk. And whenever you're talking to a surgeon, their job is to make sure they inform you about what the benefits are of the procedure, what the risks are, and what alternatives there are.
So I want to play Britt again, talking about what it was like after surgery.
Once I did get treatment, I had excessive surgery. It sort of offered almost immediate relief. It wasn't perfect relief, but it was immediate relief in the sense that I could eat foods that I was having trouble eating before. The length of my periods weren't as terrible as they were. And I generally had a better sort of day-to-day life.
And I want us to hear from another woman living with fibroids, Bessie Scott. She's 43 and was diagnosed in her early 20s after bleeding off and on during her teen years. And she described having her menstrual cycle for weeks at a time. Here's Bessie.
I'm currently looking at having a hysterectomy and had problems having my son, who is now 11 years old. I had fertility problems before him and after him, and it was blamed on me having a fibroid issue. And they have been getting worse over time. I've tried different alternative treatments, such as acupuncture, seeing a nutritionist, going to a naturopath, and it just seems to never stop or go away. And it has really kind of impacted me negatively, and it's something that I deal with constantly.
How common is it to have to get a hysterectomy because of fibroids?
It's actually really common. It's for people who have tried everything else, or people who they're in a position where there are no other alternatives available, the hysterectomy is the final way to manage and the only way to essentially 100% get rid of fibroids. And so one of the things, I know this episode is kind of talking about a lot about Black women and the impact that fibroids tend to have on people who look like us. We tend to... we tend to be more likely to end up having hysterectomies historically, and that's partially a combination of things, which it can be we either presenting later or being dismissed, and so they go undiagnosed or underdiagnosed, and they continue to grow until the point where it's hard to have less invasive interventions, but hysterectomy is a common treatment for fibroids.
Wow. So it gets to that point because, just like we were saying earlier, like women are dismissed and then Black women are even dismissed more.
And not even just that. And I guess I'll have to take a step back because there are also people where if they were to say, you know what, I have no desire for children. I want a way to get rid of this where I never have to deal with it again. Maybe their fibroids are a little bit smaller, but that is technically one of the ways that we can have to treat it so that we can tell you, okay, this is what we have available to us to not have you go through this again. But it is common where throughout medicine and different aspects of it, and including fibroids, where different people, different cultures, people who don't speak the same language, et cetera, will commonly it's common for people to feel dismissed and feel and be underdiagnosed with various conditions, which is another reason why it's important for us to advocate for ourselves as well.
The data says that 80% of Black women will have fibroids by the time they're 50. Can you talk about the disproportionate impact on Black women you have seen in your career?
I have had many people where I've either seen them where they've been saying for the past, I actually had a patient last week who said for the past 15 years, she's been dealing with heavier and heavier cycles. Like she keeps getting admitted for blood transfusions and iron infusions. And somehow along the way, she hadn't actually gotten an ultrasound or hadn't actually gotten an evaluation to really assess what was going on. And it turns out that she had pretty significantly sized fibroids. And that's a scenario where she has now had to deal with the symptoms and the aftermath of being anemic. So chronic fatigue, not really being able to do her job in the way that she typically could. And just by simply getting that diagnosis and us being able to have a treatment plan in place, we're able to significantly change the quality of life. I've seen patients where they've had what we call submucosal fibroids, which are in the inner lining of the uterus, and we remove those and they're able to get pregnant again. Like there are so many different scenarios where people end up being impacted by these, and how once they are treated and once it's addressed, how they end up having a better quality of life. I hope I answered your question.
Yeah, but is there anything that a woman can do to prevent fibroids? Is there anything with diet? I don't know, contraceptives, is there, or, you know, is it genetic?
So that's the question. There are people who are much smarter than I who are researching this right now, but we do know and acknowledge there is a genetic component to fibroids, so it's common where it can run in families. Certain populations, especially, for example, Black women are more prone to having fibroids. You can also sometimes see an association with diet, lifestyle. I think at one point someone was looking into whether or not certain hair care products were associated with it as well. And I'm not as familiar as much with the literature regarding that. So to ultimately answer your question, somewhat of it is there's not a lot that we can do to initially prevent. It's more so kind of treating when it's there. I am never, and I think no physician is ever going to tell you not to have a great diet, not to exercise, not to take care of yourself. Because I think it's easier when you're doing those things as well to recognize when something else may be wrong. Like, hey, okay, me being obese right now is not the major, like, is that a contributing factor or not? But if you're someone who is working out and who's very aware of your body and you're experiencing these symptoms, you can say, well, no one can blame that on my weight and no one can blame that on my diet. Something else is going on with me.
So we know that fibroids are non-cancerous. Do fibroids increase your risk, though, of developing cancer or a cancerous one? No.
Okay. No.
And I have, recently reported on the lawsuits against manufacturers of hair relaxers, and that connection is more about ovarian and uterine cancer, but fibroids has been coming up, so I'd be curious to see what that research looks like. But, you know, I'm a mom, and Sasha and Simons often talks about being a mom to two daughters. We both have daughters. How do you suggest that we talk to them about a health issue that seems almost inevitable in their future?
I think it's helpful to normalize talking about symptoms that you're having and advocating for yourself. And so the biggest thing I would encourage all moms of daughters is to just simply say, talk about it. When you go to the doctor, don't be afraid to bring this up. If you are, be aware of your body, be aware of your cycles, be aware of what your norm is. And so whenever you are in a position where things are out of the norm, you're able to communicate what's going on so that we can intervene sooner, so that we can evaluate you sooner, so you don't end up having a long-term sequela.
We've been talking to Dr. Constance Adams, an OBGYN at Northwestern Medicine. Thank you for coming in, Dr. Adams.
Thank you.
This episode of the Reset Podcast was produced by Micah Yasin, edited by Meha Ahmed, and mixed by Linnea Dominic. Are you interested in more conversations about health? Well, you can tune into our talk show on Tuesdays or check out our full archive of conversations at wbez.org/reset. Talk to you this afternoon.
I love how WBEZ shows different sides of the story. I never feel like it's too polarized, and I think the reporters do an excellent job of trying to get the full story, trying to show different other sides. I'm often, when I'm listening to public radio, think in my mind, well, what about X? Or like, I have another question. Or like, have they thought about X? And most of the time, WBEZ thinks about all of it, which I really appreciate.